Side 3. The Caves of Steel by Isaac Asimov. Continuing on page 84. Bailey looked back as he left the office, keeping the door open for part of an additional second. He saw the commissioner's head begin bending down toward the crook of one elbow as it rested on the desk. The plainclothes man could almost swear he heard a sob. Jehoshaphat, he thought, in outright shock. He paused in the common room and sat in the corner of a nearby desk, ignoring its occupant, who looked up, murmured a casual greeting, and returned to his work. Bailey unclipped the baffle from the bowl of the pipe and blew into it. He inverted the pipe itself over the desk's small ash vacuum and let the powdery white tobacco ash vanish. He looked regretfully at the empty pipe, readjusted the baffle, and put it away. Another pipeful gone forever. He reconsidered what had just taken place. In one way, Enderby had not surprised him. He had expected resistance to any attempt on his own part to enter Spacetown. He had learned the commissioner talk often enough about the difficulties of dealing with spacers, about the dangers of allowing any but experienced negotiators to have anything to do with them, even over trifles. He had not expected, however, to have the commissioner give in so easily. He had supposed, at the very least, that Enderby would have insisted on accompanying him. The pressure of other work was meaningless in the face of the importance of this problem. And that was not what Bailey wanted. He wanted exactly what he had gotten. He wanted the commissioner to be present by tri-dimensional personification so that he could witness the proceedings from a point of safety. Safety was the key word. Bailey would need a witness that could not be put out of the way immediately. He needed that much as the minimum guarantee of his own safety. The commissioner had agreed to that at once. Bailey remembered the parting sob, or ghost of one, and thought, Jehoshaphat, the man's into this past his depth. A cheerful, slurring voice sounded just at Bailey's shoulder, and Bailey started. What the devil do you want? He demanded savagely. The smile on R. Sammy's face remained foolishly fixed. Jack says to tell you, Daniil is ready, Lige. All right, now get out of here. He frowned at the robots departing back. There was nothing so irritating as having that clumsy metal contraption forever making free with your front name. He'd complained about that when R. Sammy first arrived, and the commissioner had shrugged his shoulders and said, You can't have it both ways, Lige. The public insists that city robots be built with a strong friendship circuit. All right, then. He is drawn to you. He calls you the friendliest name he knows. Friendship circuit. No robot built of any type could possibly hurt a human being. That was the first law of robotics. A robot may not injure a human being, or through inaction, allow a human being to come to harm. No positronic brain was ever built without that injunction driven so deeply into its basic circuits that no conceivable derangement could displace it. There was no need for specialized friendship circuits. Yet the commissioner was right. The Earthman's distrust for robots was something quite irrational, and friendship circuits had to be incorporated, just as all robots had to be made smiling. On Earth, at any rate. R. Daniil, now, never smiled. Sighing, Bailey rose to his feet. He thought, Spacetown, next stop. Or maybe last stop. The police forces of the city, as well as certain high officials, could still make use of individual squad cars along the corridors of the city, and even along the ancient underground motorways that were barred to foot traffic. There were perennial demands on the part of the liberals that these motorways be converted to children's playgrounds, to new shopping areas, or to expressway or local way extensions. The strong pleas of civic safety remained unvanquished, however. In cases of fires too large to be handled by local devices, in cases of massive breakdowns in power lines or ventilators, most of all in cases of serious riot, there had to be some means whereby the forces of the city could be mobilized at the stricken point in a hurry. No substitute for the motorways existed or could exist. Bailey had traveled along a motorway several times before in his life, but its indecent emptiness always depressed him. It seemed a million miles from the warm, living pulsation of the city. It stretched out like a blind and hollow worm before his eyes as he sat at the controls of the squad car. It opened continuously into new stretches as he moved around this gentle curve or that. Behind him, he knew without looking, another blind and hollow worm continually contracted and closed. The motorway was well lit, but lighting was meaningless in the silence and emptiness. R. Daniil did nothing to break the silence or fill that emptiness. He looked straight ahead, as unimpressed by the empty motorway as by the bulging expressway. In one sounding moment, to the tune of a wild whine or the squad car's siren, they popped out of the motorway and curved gradually into the vehicular lane of a city corridor. The vehicular lanes were still conscientiously marked down each major corridor in reverence for one vestigial portion of the past. There were no vehicles any longer, except for squad cars, fire engines, and maintenance trucks, and pedestrians used the lanes in complete self-assurance. They scattered in indignant hurry before the advance of Bailey's squealing car. Bailey himself drew a freer breath as noise surged in about him. But it was an interval only. In less than 200 yards, they turned into the subdued corridors that led to Spacetown entrance. They were expected. The guards obviously knew R. Daniil by sight, and although themselves human, nodded to him without the least self-consciousness. One approached Bailey and saluted with perfect, if frigid, military courtesy. He was tall and grave, though not the perfect specimen of spacer physique that R. Daniil was. He said, "Your identification card, if you please, sir." It was inspected quickly but thoroughly. Bailey noticed that the guard wore flesh-colored gloves and had an all but unnoticeable filter in each nostril. The guard saluted again and returned the card. He said, "There is a small men's personal here which we would be pleased to have you use if you wish to shower." It was in Bailey's mind to deny the necessity, but R. Daniil plucked gently at his sleeve as the guard stepped back to his place. R. Daniil said, "It is customary, Partner Elijah, for city dwellers to shower before entering Spacetown. I tell you this since I know you have no desire, through lack of information on this matter, to render yourself or ourselves uncomfortable. It is also advisable for you to attend to any matters of personal hygiene you may think advisable. There will be no facilities within Spacetown for that purpose." "No facilities," said Bailey strenuously. "But that's impossible." "I mean, of course," said R. Daniil, "none for use by city dwellers." Bailey's face filled with a clearly hostile astonishment. R. Daniil said, "I regret the situation, but it is a matter of custom." Wordlessly, Bailey entered the personal. He felt, rather than saw, R. Daniil entering behind him. He thought, "Checking on me? Making sure I wash the city dust off myself?" For a furious moment, he reveled in the thought of the shock he was preparing for Spacetown. It seemed to him suddenly minor that he might, in effect, be pointing a blaster at his own chest. The personal was small, but it was well appointed and antiseptic in its cleanliness. There was a trace of sharpness in the air. Bailey sniffed at it, momentarily puzzled. Then he thought, "Ozone. They've got ultraviolet radiation flooding the place." A little sign blinked on and off several times, then remained steadily lit. It said, "Visitor will please remove all clothing, including shoes, and place in the receptacle below." Bailey acquiesced. He unhitched his blaster and blaster strap and recircled it about his naked waist. It felt heavy and uncomfortable. The receptacle closed and his clothing was gone. The lighted sign blanked out. A new sign flashed ahead. It said, "Visitor will please tend to personal needs, then make use of the shower indicated by arrow." Bailey felt like a machine tool being shaped by long-distance force edges on an assembly line. His first act upon entering the small shower cubicle was to draw up the moisture-proof flap on his blaster holster and clip it down firmly all about. He knew by long-standing test that he could still draw and use it in less than 5 seconds. There was no knob or hook on which to hang his blaster. There was not even a visible showerhead. He placed it in a corner away from the cubicle's entrance door. Another sign flashed. "Visitor will please hold arms directly out from his body and stand in the central circle with feet in the indicated positions." As he placed his feet in the small depressions allowed for them, the sign blanked out. As it did so, a stinging, foaming spray hit him from ceiling, floor, and four walls. He felt the water welling up even beneath the soles of his feet. For a full minute it lasted, his skin reddening under the combined force of the heat and pressure, and his lungs gasping for air in the warm dampness. There followed another minute of cool, low-pressure spray, and then finally a minute of warm air that left him dry and refreshed. He picked up his blaster and blaster strap and found that they, too, were warm and dry. He strapped them on and stepped out of the cubicle in time to see R. Daniil emerge from a neighboring shower. Of course, R. Daniil was not a city dweller, but he had accumulated city dust. Quite automatically, Bailey looked away. Then, with the thought that, after all, R. Daniil's customs were not city customs, he forced his unwilling eyes back for one moment. His lips quirked in a tiny smile. R. Daniil's resemblance to humanity was not restricted to his face and hands, but had been carried out with painstaking accuracy over the entire body. Bailey stepped forward in the direction he had been traveling continuously since entering the personal. He found his clothes waiting for him, neatly folded. They had a warm, clean odor to them. A sign said, "Visitor will please resume his clothing and place his hand in the indicated depression." Bailey did so. He felt a definite tingling in the ball of his middle finger as he laid it down upon the clean, milky surface. He lifted his hand hastily and found a little drop of blood oozing out. As he watched, it stopped flowing. He shook it off and pinched the finger. No more blood was flowing even then. Obviously, they were analyzing his blood. He felt a definite pang of anxiety. His own yearly routine examination by department doctors, he felt sure, was not carried on with the thoroughness or perhaps with the knowledge of these cold robot makers from outer space. He was not sure he wanted too probing an inquiry into the state of his health. The time of waiting seemed long to Bailey, but when the light flashed again, it said simply, "Visitor will proceed." Bailey drew a long breath of relief. He walked onward and stepped through an archway. Two metal rods closed in before him, and written in luminous air were the words, "Visitor is warned to proceed no further." "What the devil?" called out Bailey, forgetting in his anger the fact that he was still in the personal. R. Daniil's voice was in his ear. "The sniffers have detected a power source, I imagine. Are you carrying your blaster, Elijah?" Bailey whirled, his face a deep crimson. He tried twice, then managed to croak out, "A police officer has his blaster on him, or in easy reach at all times, on duty and off." It was the first time he had spoken in a personal proper since he was 10 years old. That had been in his Uncle Boris's presence, and had merely been an automatic complaint when he stubbed his toe. Uncle Boris had beaten him well when he reached home, and had lectured him strongly on the necessities of public decency. R. Daniil said, "No visitor may be armed. It is our custom, Elijah. Even your commissioner leaves his blaster behind on all visits." Under almost any other circumstances, Bailey would have turned on his heel and walked away. Away from Spacetown and away from that robot. Now, however, he was almost mad with desire to go through with his exact plan and have his revenge to the brim in that way. This, he thought, was the unobtrusive medical examination that had replaced the more detailed one of the early days. He could well understand. He could understand to overflowing the indignation and anger that had led to the barrier riots of his youth. In black anger, Bailey unhitched his blaster belt. R. Daniil took it from him and placed it within a recess in the wall. A thin metal plate slithered across it. "If you will put your thumb in the depression," said R. Daniil, "only your thumb will open it later on." Bailey felt undressed, far more so, in fact, than he had felt in the shower. He stepped across the point at which the rods had lately barred him, and finally, out of the personal. He was back in a corridor again, but there was an element of strangeness about it. Up ahead, the light had an unfamiliar quality to it. He felt a whiff of air against his face, and automatically, he thought a squad car had passed. R. Daniil must have read his uneasiness in his face. He said, "You are essentially in open air now, Elijah. It is unconditioned." Bailey felt faintly sick. How could the spacers be so rigidly careful of a human body merely because it came from the city and then breathe the dirty air of the open fields? He tightened his nostrils, as though by pulling them together he could the more effectively screen the ingoing air. R. Daniil said, "I believe you will find that open air is not deleterious to human health." "All right," said Bailey faintly. The air currents hit annoyingly against his face. They were gentle enough, but they were erratic. That bothered him. Worse came. The corridor opened into blueness, and as they approached its end, strong white light washed down. Bailey had seen sunlight. He had been in a natural solarium once in the line of duty. But there, protecting glass had enclosed the place, and the sun's own image had been refracted into a generalized glow. Here, all was open. Automatically, he looked up at the sun, then turned away. His dazzled eyes blinked and watered. A spacer was approaching. A moment of misgiving struck Bailey. R. Daniil, however, stepped forward to greet the approaching man with a handshake. The spacer turned to Bailey and said, "Won't you come with me, sir? I am Dr. Han Fastolf." Things were better inside one of the domes. Bailey found himself goggling at the size of the rooms and the way in which space was so carelessly distributed, but was thankful for the feel of the conditioned air. Fastolf said, sitting down and crossing his long legs, "I'm assuming that you prefer conditioning to unobstructed wind." He seemed friendly enough. There were fine wrinkles on his forehead and a certain flabbiness to the skin below his eyes and just under his chin. His hair was thinning, but showed no signs of gray. His large ears stood away from his head, giving him a humorous and homely appearance that comforted Bailey. Early that morning, Bailey had looked once again at those pictures of Spacetown that Enderby had taken. R. Daniil had just arranged the Spacetown appointment, and Bailey was absorbing the notion that he was to meet spacers in the flesh. Somehow, that was considerably different from speaking to them across miles of carrier wave, as he had done on several occasions before. The spacers in those pictures had been, generally speaking, like those that were occasionally featured in the book films. Tall, red-headed, grave, coldly handsome. Like R. Daniil Olivaw, for instance. R. Daniil named the spacers for Bailey, and when Bailey suddenly pointed and said in surprise, "That isn't you, is it?" R. Daniil answered, "No, Elijah. That is my designer, Dr. Sartin." He said it unemotionally. "You were made in your maker's image?" asked Bailey sardonically. But there was no answer to that, and in truth, Bailey scarcely expected one. The Bible, as he knew, circulated only to the most limited extent on the outer worlds. And now Bailey looked at Han Fastolf, a man who deviated very noticeably from the spacer norm in looks, and the Earthman felt pronounced gratitude for that fact. "Won't you accept food?" asked Fastolf. He indicated the table that separated himself and R. Daniil from the Earthman. It bore nothing but a bowl of vari-colored spheroids. Bailey felt vaguely startled. He had taken them for table decorations. R. Daniil explained, "These are the fruits of natural plant life grown on Aurora. I suggest you try this kind. It is called an apple, and is reputed to be pleasant." Fastolf smiled. R. Daniil does not know this by personal experience, of course, but he is quite right. Bailey brought an apple to his mouth. Its surface was red and green. It was cool to the touch and had a faint but pleasant odor. With an effort, he bit into it, and the unexpected tartness of the pulpy contents hurt his teeth. He chewed it gingerly. City dwellers ate natural food, of course, whenever rations allowed it. He himself had eaten natural meat and bread often. But such food had always been processed in some way. It had been cooked or ground, blended or compounded. Fruit now, properly speaking, should come in the form of sauce or preserve. What he was holding now must have come straight from the dirt of a planet's soil. He thought, "I hope they've washed it at least." Again he wondered at the spottiness of spacer notions concerning cleanliness. Fastolf said, "Let me introduce myself a bit more specifically. I am in charge of the investigation of the murder of Dr. Sarton at the Spacetown end, as Commissioner Enderby is at the city end. If I can help you in any way, I stand ready to do so. We are as eager for a quiet solution of the affair and prevention of future incidents of the sort as any of you city men can be. Thank you, Dr. Fastolf, said Bailey. Your attitude is appreciated. So much, he thought, for the amenities. He bit into the center of the apple, and hard, dark little ovoids popped into his mouth. He spat automatically. They flew out and fell to the ground. One would have struck Fastolf's leg had not the spacer moved it hastily. Bailey reddened, started to bend. Fastolf said pleasantly, It is quite all right, Mr. Bailey. Just leave them, please. Bailey straightened again. He put the apple down gingerly. He had the uncomfortable feeling that once he was gone, the lost little objects would be found and picked up by suction. The bowl of fruit would be burnt or discarded far from Spacetown. The very room they were sitting in would be sprayed with viricide. He covered his embarrassment with brusqueness. He said, I would like to ask permission to have Commissioner Enderby join our conference by trimensional personification. Fastolf's eyebrows raised. Certainly, if you wish it. Daniil, would you make the connection? Bailey sat in stiff discomfort until the shiny surface of the large parallelepiped in one corner of the room dissolved away to show Commissioner Julius Enderby and part of his desk. At that moment, the discomfort eased, and Bailey felt nothing short of love for that familiar figure, and a longing to be safely back in that office with him, or anywhere in the city, for that matter. Even in the least prepossessing portion of the Jersey yeast vat districts. Now that he had his witness, Bailey saw no reason for delay. He said, I believe I have penetrated the mystery surrounding the death of Dr. Sarton. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Enderby springing to his feet and grabbing wildly, and successfully, at his flying spectacles. By standing, the commissioner thrust his head out of limits of the trimensic receiver and was forced to sit down again, red-faced and speechless. In a much quieter way, Dr. Fastolf, head inclined to one side, was startled. Only R. Daniil was unmoved. Do you mean, said Fastolf, that you know the murderer? No, said Bailey. I mean, there was no murder.
What?
Screamed Enderby. One moment, Commissioner Enderby, said Fastolf, raising a hand. His eyes held Bailey's, and he said, Do you mean that Dr. Sarton is alive? Yes, sir, and I believe I know where he is.
Where?
Right there, said Bailey, and pointed firmly at R. Daniil Oliver. 8. Debate over a robot. At the moment, Bailey was most conscious of the thud of his own pulse. He seemed to be living in a moment of suspended time. R. Daniil's expression was, as always, empty of emotion. Han Fastolf wore a look of well-bred astonishment on his face and nothing more. It was Commissioner Julius Enderby's reaction that most concerned Bailey, however. The trimensic receiver out of which his face stared did not allow of perfect reproduction. There was always that tiny flicker and that not quite ideal resolution. Through that imperfection and through the further masking of the commissioner's spectacles, Enderby's eyes were unreadable. Bailey thought, Don't go to pieces on me, Julius. I need you. He didn't really think that Fastolf would act in haste or under emotional impulse. He had read somewhere once that spacers had no religion, but substituted instead a cold and phlegmatic intellectualism raised to the heights of a philosophy. He believed that and counted on it. They would make a point of acting slowly, and then only on the basis of reason. If he were alone among them and had said what he had said, he was certain that he would never have returned to the city. Cold reason would have dictated that. The spacer's plans were more to them, many times over, than the life of a city dweller. There would be some excuse made to Julius Enderby. Maybe they would present his corpse to the commissioner, shake their heads, and speak of an Earthman conspiracy having struck again. The commissioner would believe them. It was the way he was built. If he hated spacers, it was a hatred based on fear. He wouldn't dare disbelieve them. That was why he had to be an actual witness of events. A witness, moreover, safely out of reach of the spacer's calculated safety measures. The commissioner said chokingly, "Lige, you're all wrong. I saw Dr. Sarton's corpse." "You saw the charred remnants of something you were told was Dr. Sarton's corpse," retorted Bailey boldly. He thought grimly of the commissioner's broken glasses. That had been an unexpected favor for the spacers. "No, no, Lige. I knew Dr. Sarton well, and his head was undamaged. It was he." The commissioner put his hand to his glasses uneasily, as though he too remembered, and added, "I looked at him closely, very closely." "How about this one, commissioner?" asked Bailey, pointing to R. Daniel again. "Doesn't he resemble Dr. Sarton?" "Yes, the way a statue would." "An expressionless attitude can be assumed, commissioner. Suppose that were a robot you had seen blasted to death. You say you looked closely. Did you look closely enough to see whether the charred surface at the edge of the blast was really decomposed organic tissue, or a deliberately introduced layer of carbonization over fused metal?" The commissioner looked revolted. He said, "You're being ridiculous." Bailey turned to the spacer. "Are you willing to have the body exhumed for examination, Dr. Fastolf?" Dr. Fastolf smiled. "Ordinarily, I would have no objection, Mr. Bailey. But I'm afraid we do not bury our dead. Cremation is a universal custom among us." "Very convenient," said Bailey. "Tell me, Mr. Bailey," said Dr. Fastolf, "just how did you arrive at this very extraordinary conclusion of yours?" Bailey thought, "He isn't giving up. He'll brazen it out if he can." He said, "It wasn't difficult. There's more to imitating a robot than just putting on a frozen expression and adopting a stilted style of conversation. The trouble with you men of the outer worlds is that you're too used to robots. You've gotten to accept them almost as human beings. You've grown blind to the differences. On Earth, it's different. We're very conscious of what a robot is. Now, in the first place, R. Daniel is too good a human to be a robot. My first impression of him was that he was a spacer. It was quite an effort for me to adjust myself to his statement that he was a robot. And, of course, the reason for that was that he was a spacer and wasn't a robot." R. Daniel interrupted without any sign of self-consciousness at being himself so intimately the topic of debate. He said, "As I told you, partner Elijah, I was designed to take a temporary place in a human society. The resemblance to humanity is purposeful." "Even," asked Bailey, "down to the painstaking duplication of those portions of the body which, in the ordinary course of events, would always be covered by clothes? Even to the duplication of organs which, in a robot, would have no conceivable function?" Enderby said suddenly, "How did you find that out?" Bailey reddened. "I couldn't help noticing in the personal." Enderby looked shocked. Fastolf said, "Surely you understand that a resemblance must be complete, if it is to be useful. For our purposes, half measures are as bad as nothing at all." Bailey asked abruptly, "May I smoke?" 3 pipefuls in one day was a ridiculous extravagance, but he was riding a rolling torrent of recklessness and needed the release of tobacco. After all, he was talking back to spacers. He was going to force their lies down their own throats. Fastolf said, "I'm sorry, but I'd prefer that you didn't." It was a preference that had the force of a command. Bailey felt that. He thrust back the pipe, the bowl of which he had already taken into his hand in anticipation of automatic permission. "Of course not," he thought bitterly. "Enderby didn't warn me because he doesn't smoke himself. But it's obvious. It follows. They don't smoke on their hygienic outer worlds, or drink, or have any human vices. No wonder they accept robots in their damned... what did R. Daniel call it? Sci-fee society. No wonder R. Daniel can play the robot as well as he does. They're all robots out there to begin with." He said, "The two complete resemblance is just 1 point out of a number. There was a near riot in my section as I was taking him home." He had to point. He could not bring himself to say either R. Daniel or Dr. Sarton. It was he that stopped the trouble, and he did it by pointing a blaster at the potential rioters.
Good Lord,
said Enderby energetically. The report stated that it was you. I know, Commissioner, said Bailey. The report was based on information that I gave. I didn't want to have it on the record that a robot had threatened to blast men and women.
No, no, of course not.
Enderby was quite obviously horrified. He leaned forward to look at something that was out of the range of the trimensic receiver. Bailey could guess what it was. The commissioner was checking the power gauge to see if the transmitter were tapped. Is that a point in your argument? Asked Fastolf. It certainly is. The first law of robotics states that a robot cannot harm a human being. But our Daniil did no harm.
True.
He even stated afterward that he wouldn't have fired under any circumstances. Still, no robot I ever heard of could have violated the spirit of the first law to the extent of threatening to blast a man, even if he really had no intention to do so. I see. Are you a robotics expert, Mr. Bailey?
No, sir. But I've had a course in general robotics and positronic analysis. I'm not completely ignorant.
That's nice, said Fastolf agreeably. But you see, I am a robotics expert, and I assure you that the essence of the robot mind lies in a completely literal interpretation of the universe. It recognizes no spirit in the first law, only the letter. The simple models you have on Earth may have their first law so overlaid with additional safeguards that, to be sure, they may well be incapable of threatening a human. An advanced model such as our Daniil is another matter. If I gathered the situation correctly, Daniil's threat was necessary to prevent a riot. It was intended, then, to prevent harm to human beings. He was obeying the first law, not defying it. Bailey squirmed inwardly, but maintained a tight external calm. It would go hard, but he would match this spacer at his own game. He said, "You may counter each point separately, but they add up just the same. Last evening, in our discussion of the so-called murder, this alleged robot claimed that he had been converted into a detective by the installation of a new drive into his positronic circuits. A drive, if you please, for justice."
"I'll vouch for that," said Fastolf. "It was done to him 3 days ago under my own supervision."
"A drive for justice?" "Justice, Dr. Fastolf, is an abstraction. Only a human being can use the term."
"If you define justice in such a way that it is an abstraction, if you say that it is the rendering of each man his due, that it is adhering to the right, or anything of the sort, I grant you your argument, Mr. Bailey. A human understanding of abstractions cannot be built into a positronic brain in the present state of our knowledge."
"You admit that, then, as an expert in robotics?"
"Certainly. The question is, what did R. Daniil mean by using the term justice?"
"From the context of our own conversation, he meant what you and I and any human being would mean, but what no robot could mean."
"Why don't you ask him, Mr. Bailey, to define the term?"
Bailey felt a certain loss of confidence. He turned to R. Daniil. "Well?"
"Yes, Elijah?"
"What is your definition of justice?"
"Justice, Elijah, is that which exists when all the laws are enforced."
Fastolf nodded. "A good definition, Mr. Bailey, for a robot. The desire to see all laws enforced has been built into our Daniil now. Justice is a very concrete term to him, since it is based on law enforcement, which is in turn based upon the existence of specific and definite laws. There is nothing abstract about it. A human being can recognize the fact that, on the basis of an abstract moral code, some laws may be bad ones and their enforcement unjust. What do you say, R. Daniil?"
"An unjust law," said R. Daniil evenly, "is a contradiction in terms."
"To a robot, it is, Mr. Bailey. So you see, you mustn't confuse your justice and R. Daniil's."
Bailey turned to R. Daniil sharply and said, "You left my apartment last night." R. Daniil replied, "I did. If my leaving disturbed your sleep, I am sorry."
"Where did you go?" to the men's personal. For a moment, Bailey was staggered. It was the answer he had already decided was the truth, but he had not expected it to be the answer R. Daniil would give. He felt a little more of his certainty oozing away, yet he held firmly on his track. The commissioner was watching, his lensed eyes flicking from one to the other as they spoke. Bailey couldn't back down now, no matter what sophistries they used against him. He had to hold to his point. He said, on reaching my section, he insisted on entering personal with me. His excuse was a poor one. During the night, he left to visit personal again, as he has just admitted. If he were a man, I'd say he had every reason and right to do so. Obviously. As a robot, however, the trip was meaningless. The conclusion can only be that he is a man. Fastolf nodded. He seemed not in the least put out. He said, "This is most interesting. Suppose we ask Daniil why he made his trip to personal last night." Commissioner Enderby leaned forward.
"Please, Dr. Fastolf," he muttered. "It is not proper to..."
"You need not be concerned, Commissioner," said Fastolf, his thin lips curving back in something that looked like a smile but wasn't. "I'm certain that Daniil's answer will not offend your sensibilities or those of Mr. Bailey. Won't you tell us, Daniil?" R. Daniil said, "Elijah's wife, Jessie, left the apartment last night on friendly terms with me. It was quite obvious that she had no reason for thinking me to be other than human. She returned to the apartment knowing I was a robot. The obvious conclusion is that the information to that effect exists outside the apartment. It followed that my conversation with Elijah last night had been overheard. In no other way could the secret of my true nature have become common knowledge. Elijah told me that the apartments were well insulated. We spoke together in low voices. Ordinary eavesdropping would not do. Still, it was known that Elijah is a policeman. If a conspiracy exists within the city sufficiently well organized to have planned the murder of Dr. Sarton, they may well have been aware that Elijah had been placed in charge of the murder investigation. It would fall within the realm of possibility, then, even of probability, that his apartment had been spy-beamed. I searched the apartment as well as I could after Elijah and Jesse had gone to bed, but could find no transmitter. This complicated matters. A focused duo-beam could do the trick even in the absence of a transmitter, but that requires rather elaborate equipment. Analysis of the situation led to the following conclusion. The one place where a city dweller can do almost anything without being disturbed or questioned is in the personals. He could even set up a duo-beam. The custom of absolute privacy in the personals is very strong, and other men would not even look at him. The section personal is quite close to Elijah's apartment, so that the distance factor is not important. A suitcase model could be used. I went to the personal to investigate.
And what did you find? Asked Bailey quickly.
Nothing, Elijah. No sign of a duo-beam. Dr. Fastolf said, Well, Mr. Bailey, does this sound reasonable to you? But Bailey's uncertainty was gone now. He said, Reasonable as far as it goes, perhaps, but it stops short of perfection by a hell of a way. What he doesn't know is that my wife told me where she got the information and when. She learned he was a robot shortly after she left the house. Even then, the rumor had been circulating for hours. So the fact that he was a robot could not have leaked out through spying on our last evening's conversation. Nevertheless, said Dr. Fastolf, his action last night of going to the personal stands explained, I think.
But something is brought up that is not explained, retorted Bailey heatedly. When, where, and how was the leak? How did the news get about that there was a spacer robot in the city? As far as I know, only two of us knew about the deal, Commissioner Enderby and myself, and we told no one. Commissioner, did anyone else in the department know?
No,
said Enderby anxiously. Not even the mayor. Only we and Dr. Fastolf.
And he, added Bailey, pointing.
I? Asked R. Daniil.
Why not?
I was with you at all times, Elijah.
You were not!
Cried Bailey fiercely. I was in personal for half an hour or more before we went to my apartment. During that time, we two were completely out of contact with one another. It was then that you got in touch with your group in the city.
What group? Asked Fastolf.
And what group?
Echoed Commissioner Enderby almost simultaneously.
Bailey rose from his chair and turned to the Trimensic receiver. Commissioner, I want you to listen closely to this. Tell me if it doesn't all fall into a pattern. A murder is reported, and by a curious coincidence, it happens just as you are entering Spacetown to keep an appointment with the murdered man. You are shown the corpse of something supposed to be human, but the corpse has since been disposed of and is not available for close examination. The spacers insist an Earthman did the killing, even though the only way they can make such an accusation stick is to suppose that a city man had left the city and cut cross-country to Spacetown alone and at night. You know damn well how unlikely that is. Next, they send a supposed robot into the city. In fact, they insist on sending him. The first thing the robot does is to threaten a crowd of human beings with a blaster. The second is to set in motion the rumor that there is a spacer robot in the city. In fact, the rumor is so specific that Jesse told me it was known that he was working with the police. That means that before long it will be known that it was the robot who handled the blaster. Maybe even now the rumor is spreading across the yeast vat country and down the Long Island hydroponic plants that there's a killer robot on the loose. This is impossible! Impossible! Groaned Enderby. No, it isn't. It's exactly what's happening, Commissioner. Don't you see it? There is a conspiracy in the city, all right, but it's run from Spacetown. The spacers want to be able to report a murder. They want riots. They want an assault on Spacetown. The worse things get, the better the incident. And spacer ships come down and occupy the cities of Earth. Fastolf said mildly, We had an excuse in the barrier riots of 25 years ago. You weren't ready then. You are now. Bailey's heart was pounding madly. This is quite a complicated plot you're attributing to us, Mr. Bailey. If we wanted to occupy Earth, we could do so in much simpler fashion. Maybe not, Dr. Fastolf. Your so-called robot told me that public opinion concerning Earth is by no means unified on your outer worlds. I think he was telling the truth at that time, anyway. Maybe an outright occupation wouldn't sit well with the people at home. Maybe an incident is an absolute necessity. A good, shocking incident. Like a murder, eh? Is that it? You'll admit it would have to be a pretended murder. You won't suggest, I hope, that we'd really kill one of ourselves for the sake of an incident? You built a robot to look like Dr. Sarton, blasted the robot, and showed the remains to Commissioner Enderby. And then, said Dr. Fastolf, having used R. Daniil to impersonate Dr. Sarton in the false murder, we have to use Dr. Sarton to impersonate R. Daniil in the false investigation of the false murder. Exactly. I am telling you this in the presence of a witness who is not here in the flesh and whom you cannot blast out of existence and who is important enough to be believed by the city government and by Washington itself. We will be prepared for you, and we know what your intentions are. If necessary, our government will report directly to your people, expose the situation for exactly what it is. I doubt if this sort of interstellar rape will be tolerated. Fastolf shook his head. Please, Mr. Bailey, you are being unreasonable. Really, you have the most astonishing notions. Suppose now, just quietly suppose, that R. Daniil is really R. Daniil. Suppose he is actually a robot. Wouldn't it follow that the corpse Commissioner Enderby saw was really Dr. Sarton? It would be scarcely reasonable to believe that the corpse were still another robot. Commissioner Enderby witnessed R. Daniil under construction and can vouch for the fact that only one existed. If it comes to that, said Bailey stubbornly, the commissioner is not a robotics expert. You might have had a dozen such robots. Stick to the point, Mr. Bailey. What if R. Daniil is really R. Daniil? Would not the entire structure of your reasoning fall to the ground? Would you have any further basis for your belief in this completely melodramatic and implausible interstellar plot you have constructed? If he is a robot, I say he is human. Yet you haven't really investigated the problem, Mr. Bailey, said Fastolf. To differentiate a robot, even a very humanoid robot, from a human being,
It isn't necessary to make elaborately shaky deductions from little things he says and does. For instance, have you tried sticking a pin into Ardenil? What? Bailey's mouth fell open. It's a simple experiment. There are others, perhaps, not quite so simple. His skin and hair look real, but have you tried looking at them under adequate magnification? Then again, he seems to breathe, particularly when he is using air to talk. But have you noticed that his breathing is irregular, that minutes may go by during which he has no breath at all? You might even have trapped some of his expired air and measured the carbon dioxide content. You might have tried to draw a sample of blood. You might have tried to detect a pulse in his wrist or a heartbeat under his shirt. Do you see what I mean, Mr. Bailey? That's just talk, said Bailey uneasily. I'm not going to be bluffed. I might have tried any of those things, but do you suppose this alleged robot would have let me bring a hypodermic to him? Or a stethoscope? Or a microscope? Of course. I see your point, said Fastolf. He looked at Ardenil and gestured slightly. Ardenil touched the cuff of his right shirt sleeve, and the diamagnetic seam fell apart the entire length of his arm. A smooth, sinewy, and apparently entirely human limb lay exposed. Its short bronze hairs, both in quantity and distribution, were exactly what one would expect of a human being. Bailey said, "So?" Ardenil pinched the ball of his right middle finger with the thumb and forefinger of his left hand. Exactly what the details of the manipulation that followed were, Bailey could not see. But just as the fabric of the sleeve had fallen in two when the diamagnetic field of its seam had been interrupted, so now the arm itself fell in two. There, under a thin layer of flesh-like material, was the dull blue-gray of stainless steel rods, cords, and joints. Would you care to examine Daniel's workings more closely, Mr. Bailey? Asked Dr. Fastolf politely. Bailey could scarcely hear the remark for the buzzing in his ears and for the sudden jarring of the commissioner's high-pitched and hysterical laughter. 9. Elucidation by a spacer. The minutes passed and the buzzing grew louder and drowned out the laughter. The dome and all it contained wavered, and Bailey's time sense wavered too. At last he found himself sitting in an unchanged position, but with a definite feeling of lost time. The commissioner was gone. The trimensic receiver was milky and opaque, and Ardenil sat at his side, pinching up the skin of Bailey's bared upper arm. Bailey could see, just beneath the skin, the small, thin darkness of a hyposliver. It vanished as he watched, soaking and spreading away into the intercellular fluid, from that into the bloodstream and the neighboring cells, from that into all the cells of his body. His grip on reality heightened. "Do you feel better, partner Elijah?" asked Ardenil. Bailey did. He pulled at his arm, and the robot let him take it away. He rolled down his sleeve and looked about. Dr. Fastolf sat where he had been, a small smile softening the homeliness of his face. Bailey said, "Did I black out?" Dr. Fastolf said, "In a way, yes. You received a sizable shock, I'm afraid." It came back to Bailey quite clearly. He seized R. Daniel's nearer arm quickly, forcing up the sleeve as far as it would go, exposing the wrist. The robot's flesh felt soft to his fingers, but underneath was the hardness of something more than bone. R. Daniel let his arm rest easily in the plainclothes man's grip. Bailey stared at it, pinching the skin along the median line. Was there a faint seam? It was logical, of course, that there should be. A robot covered with synthetic skin and deliberately made to look human could not be repaired in the ordinary fashion. A chest plate could not be unriveted for the purpose. A skull could not be hinged up and outward. Instead, the various parts of the mechanical body would have to be put together along a line of micromagnetic fields. An arm, a head, an entire body must fall in two at the proper touch, then come together again at a contrary touch. Bailey looked up. "Where's the commissioner?" he mumbled, hot with mortification. "Pressing business," said Dr. Fastolf. I encouraged him to leave, I'm afraid. I assured him we would take care of you.
You've taken care of me quite nicely already, thank you, said Bailey grimly. I think our business is done.
He lifted himself erect on tired joints. He felt an old man very suddenly, too old to start over again. He needed no deep insight to foresee that future. The commissioner would be half frightened and half furious. He would face Bailey whitely, taking his glasses off to wipe them every 15 seconds. His soft voice, Julius Enderby almost never shouted, would explain carefully that the spacers had been mortally offended.
You can't talk to spacers that way, Lige. They won't take it.
Bailey could hear Enderby's voice very plainly down to the finest shade of intonation.
I warned you. No saying how much damage you've done. I can see your point, mind you. I see what you were trying to do. If they were Earthmen, it would be different. I'd say yes, chance it. Run the risk. Smoke them out. But spacers! You might have told me, Lige. You might have consulted me. I know them. I know them inside and out.
And what would Bailey be able to say? That Enderby was exactly the man he couldn't tell? That the project was one of tremendous risk, and Enderby a man of tremendous caution? That it had been Enderby himself who had pointed up the supreme dangers of either outright failure or of the wrong kind of success? That the one way of defeating declassification was to show that guilt lay in Spacetown itself? Enderby would say,
there'll have to be a report on this, Lige. There'll be all sorts of repercussions. I know the spacers. They'll demand your removal from the case, and it'll have to be that way. You understand that, Lige, don't you? I'll try to make it easy on you. You can count on that. I'll protect you as far as I can, Lige.
Bailey knew that would be exactly true. The commissioner would protect him, but only as far as he could, not to the point, for instance, of infuriating further an angry mayor. He could hear the mayor, too.
Damn it, Enderby, what is all this? Why wasn't I consulted? Who's running the city? Why wasn't an authorized robot allowed inside the city? And just what the devil did this Bailey...
If it came to a choice between Bailey's future in the department and the commissioner's own, what possible result could Bailey expect? He could find no reasonable way of blaming Enderby. The least he could expect was demotion, and that was bad enough. The mere act of living in a modern city ensured the bare possibility of existence, even for those entirely declassified. How bare that possibility was, he knew only too well. It was the addition of status that brought the little things. A more comfortable seat here, a better cut of meat there, a shorter wait in line at the other place. To the philosophical mind, these items might seem scarcely worth any great trouble to acquire. Yet no one, however philosophical, could give up those privileges once acquired without a pang. That was the point. What a trifling addition to the convenience of the apartment an activated wash basin was, when for 30 years previously the trip to personal had been an automatic and unregarded one. How useless it was, even as a device to prove status, when it was considered the height of ill form to parade status. Yet were the wash basin to be deactivated, how humiliating and unbearable would each added trip to personal be. How yearningly attractive the memory of the bedroom shave, how filled with a sense of lost luxury. It was fashionable for modern political writers to look back with a smug disapproval at the fiscalism of medieval times, when economy was based on money. The competitive struggle for existence, they said, was brutal. No truly complex society could be maintained because of the strains introduced by the eternal fight for the buck. Scholars had varying interpretations of the word buck, but there was no dispute over the meaning as a whole. By contrast, modern civism was praised highly as efficient and enlightened. Maybe so. There were historical novels both in the romantic and the sensational tradition, and the medievalists thought fiscalism had bred such things as individualism and initiative. Bailey wouldn't commit himself, but now he wondered sickly if ever a man fought harder for that buck, whatever it was, or felt its loss more deeply than a city dweller fought to keep from losing his Sunday night option on a chicken drumstick. A real flesh drumstick from a once living bird. Bailey thought, not me so much. There's Jesse and Ben.
Dr. Fastolf's voice broke in upon his thoughts. Mr. Bailey, do you hear me? Bailey blinked. Yes? How long had he been standing there like a frozen fool? Won't you sit down, sir? Having taken care of the matter on your mind, you may now be interested in some films we have taken of the scene of the crime and of the events immediately following. No, thank you. I have business in the city. Surely the case of Dr. Sarton comes first. Not with me. I imagine I'm off the case already. Suddenly he boiled over. Damn it! If you could prove R. Daniel was a robot, why didn't you do it at once? Why did you make such a farce of it all? My dear Mr. Bailey, I was very interested in your deductions. As for being off the case, I doubt it. Before the commissioner left, I made a special point of asking that you be retained. I believe he will cooperate. Bailey sat down, not entirely voluntarily. He said sharply, Why? Dr. Fastolf crossed his legs and sighed. Mr. Bailey, in general, I have met two kinds of city dwellers, rioters and politicians. Your commissioner is useful to us, but he is a politician. He tells us what we want to hear. He handles us, if you know what I mean. Now, you came here and boldly accused us of tremendous crimes and tried to prove your case. I enjoyed the process. I found it a hopeful development. How hopeful? Asked Bailey sardonically. Hopeful enough. You are someone I can deal with frankly. Last night, Mr. Bailey, R. Daniel reported to me by shielded sub-ether. Some things about you interested me very much. For instance, there was the point concerning the nature of the book films in your apartment. What about them? A good many dealt with historical and archaeological subjects. It makes it appear that you are interested in human society, and that you know a little about its evolution. Even policemen can spend their free time on book films if they so choose. Quite. I'm glad of your choice in viewing matter. It will help me in what I'm trying to do. In the first place, I want to explain, or try to, the exclusivism of the men of the outer worlds. We live here in Spacetown. We don't enter the city. We mingle with you city dwellers only in a very rigidly limited fashion. We breathe the open air, but when we do, we wear filters. I sit here now with filters in my nostrils, gloves on my hands, and a fixed determination to come no closer to you than I can help. Why do you suppose that is? Bailey said, There's no point in guessing. Let him talk now. If you guessed, as some of your people do, you would say that it was because we despise the men of Earth and refused to lose caste by allowing their shadow to fall upon us. That is not so. The true answer is really quite obvious. The medical examination you went through, as well as the cleansing procedures, were not matters of ritual. They were dictated by necessity. Disease? Yes, disease. My dear Mr. Bailey, the Earthmen who colonized the outer worlds found themselves on planets entirely free of terrestrial bacteria and viruses. They brought their own, of course, but they also brought with them the latest medical and microbiological techniques. They had a small community of microorganisms to deal with, and no intermediate hosts. There were no mosquitoes to spread malaria, no snails to spread schistosomiasis. Disease agents were wiped out, and symbiotic bacteria allowed to grow. Gradually, the outer worlds became disease-free. Naturally, as time went on, entrance requirements for immigrant Earthmen were made more and more rigorous, since less and less could the outer worlds endure the possible introduction of disease. You've never been sick, Dr. Fastolf? Not with a parasitic disease, Mr. Bailey. We are all liable to degenerative diseases, such as atherosclerosis, of course. But I have never had what you would call a cold. If I were to contract one, I might die of it. I've built up no resistance to it whatsoever. That's what's wrong with us here in Spacetown. Those of us who come here run a definite risk. Earth is riddled with diseases to which we have no defense, no natural defense. You yourself are carrying the germs of almost every known disease. You are not aware of it, since you keep them all under control at almost all times through the antibodies your body has developed over the years. I myself lack the antibodies. Do you wonder that I come no closer to you? Believe me, Mr. Bailey, I act aloof only in self-defense. Bailey said, if this is so, why isn't the fact made known on Earth? I mean, that it is not just queasiness on your part, but a defense against an actual physical danger. The spacer shook his head. We are few, Mr. Bailey, and are disliked as foreigners anyway. We maintain our own safety on the basis of a rather shaky prestige as a superior class of being. We cannot afford to lose face by admitting that we are afraid to approach an Earthman. Not at least until there is a better understanding between Earthmen and spacers. There won't be, on present terms. It's your supposed superiority that they hate you for. It is a dilemma. Don't think we aren't aware of it. Does the Commissioner know of this? We have never explained it to him flatly, as I have just done to you. He may guess it, however. He is quite an intelligent man. If he guessed it, he might have told me, Bailey said reflectively. Dr. Fastolf lifted his eyebrows. If he had, then you wouldn't have considered the possibility of R. Daniil being a human spacer. Is that it? Bailey shrugged slightly, tossing the matter to one side. But Dr. Fastolf went on. That's quite true, you know. Putting the psychological difficulties to one side, the terrible effect of the noise and crowds upon us, the fact remains that for one of us to enter the city is the equivalent of a death sentence. It is why Dr. Sarton initiated his project of humanoid robots. They were substitute men designed to enter the city instead of us. Yes. R. Daniil explained this to me. Do you disapprove? Look, said Bailey, since we're talking to one another so freely, let me ask a question in simple words. Why have you spacers come to Earth anyway? Why don't you leave us alone? Dr. Fastolf said with obvious surprise, are you satisfied with life on Earth? We get along, yes. But for how long will that continue? Your population goes up continuously. The available calories meet the needs only as a result of greater and greater effort. Earth is in a blind alley, man. We get along, repeated Bailey stubbornly. Barely. A city like New York must spend every ounce of effort getting water in and waste out. The nuclear power plants are kept going by uranium supplies that are constantly more difficult to obtain, even from the other planets of the system. And the supply needed goes up steadily. The life of the city depends every moment on the arrival of wood pulp for the yeast vats and minerals for the hydroponic plants. Air must be circulated unceasingly. The balance is a very delicate one in 100 directions, and growing more delicate each year. What would happen to New York if the tremendous flow of input and outgo were to be interrupted for even a single hour? It never has been, which is no security for the future. In primitive times, individual population centers were virtually self-supporting, living on the produce of neighboring farms. Nothing but immediate disaster, a flood, or a pestilence, or crop failure, could harm them. As the centers grew and technology improved, localized disasters could be overcome by drawing on help from distant centers, but at the cost of making ever larger areas interdependent. In medieval times, the open cities, even the largest, could subsist on food stores and on emergency supplies of all sorts for a week at least. When New York first became a city, it could have lived on itself for a day. Now it cannot do so for an hour. A disaster that would have been uncomfortable 10,000 years ago, merely serious 1,000 years ago, and acute 100 years ago, would now be surely fatal. Bailey moved restlessly in his chair. I've heard all this before. The medievalists want an end to cities. They want us to get back to the soil, into natural agriculture. Well, they're mad. We can't. There are too many of us, and you can't go backward in history, only forward. Of course, if emigration to the outer worlds were not restricted, you know why it must be restricted. Then what is there to do? You're tapping a dead power line.
What about emigration to new worlds? There are 100 billion stars in the galaxy. It is estimated that there are 100 million planets that are inhabitable, or can be made inhabitable. That's ridiculous. Why? Asked Dr. Fastolf with vehemence. Why is the suggestion ridiculous? Earthmen have colonized planets in the past. Over 30 of the 50 outer worlds, including my native Aurora, were directly colonized by Earthmen. Is colonization no longer possible? Well, no answer. Let me suggest that if it is no longer possible, it is because of the development of city culture on Earth. Before the cities, human life on Earth wasn't so specialized that they couldn't break loose and start all over on a raw world. They did it 30 times. But now Earthmen are all so coddled, so enwombed in their imprisoning caves of steel, that they are caught forever. You, Mr. Bailey, won't even believe that a city dweller is capable of crossing country to get to Spacetown. Crossing space to get to a new world must represent impossibility squared to you. Civism is ruining Earth, sir. Bailey said angrily, and if it does? How does it concern you people? It's our problem. We'll solve it. If not, it's our own particular road to hell. Better your own road to hell than another's road to heaven, eh? I know how you must feel. It is not pleasant to listen to the preaching of a stranger. Yet I wish your people could preach to us, for we too have a problem, one that is quite analogous to yours. Bailey smiled crookedly. Overpopulation? Analogous, not identical. Ours is underpopulation. How old would you say I was? The Earthman considered for a moment and then deliberately overestimated. 60, I'd say. 160, you should say. What? 163 next birthday, to be exact. There's no trick to that. I'm using the standard Earth year as the unit. If I'm fortunate, if I take care of myself, most of all, if I catch no disease on Earth, I may double that age. Men on Aurora have been known to live over 350 years, and life expectancy is still increasing. Bailey looked to R. Daniil, who throughout the conversation had been listening in stolid silence, as though he were seeking confirmation. He said, "How is that possible? In an underpopulated society, it is practical to concentrate study on gerontology, to do research on the aging process. In a world such as yours, a lengthened life expectancy would be disastrous. You couldn't afford the resulting rise in population. On Aurora, there is room for tricentenarians. Then, of course, a long life becomes doubly and triply precious. If you were to die now, you would lose perhaps 40 years of your life. Probably less. If I were to die, I would lose 150 years, probably more. In a culture such as ours, then, individual life is of prime importance. Our birth rate is low and population increase is rigidly controlled. We maintain a definite robot-man ratio designed to maintain the individual in the greatest comfort. Logically, developing children are carefully screened for physical and mental defects before being allowed to mature." Bailey interrupted. "You mean you kill them if they don't measure up?" "Quite painlessly, I assure you." "The notion shocks you, just as the Earthman's uncontrolled breeding shocks us." "We're controlled, Dr. Fastolf. Each family is allowed so many children." Dr. Fastolf smiled tolerantly. "So many of any kind of children. Not so many healthy children. And even so, there are many illegitimates, and your population increases. Who's to judge which children should live?" "That's rather complicated and not to be answered in a sentence. Someday we may talk it out in detail." "Well, where's your problem? You sound satisfied with your society." "It is stable." "That's the trouble. It is too stable." Bailey said, "Nothing pleases you. Our civilization is at the ragged edge of chaos, according to you, and your own is too stable." "It is possible to be too stable. No outer world has colonized a new planet in 2.5 centuries. there is no prospect for colonization in the future. Our lives in the outer worlds are too long to risk and too comfortable to upset. I don't know about that, Dr. Fastolf. You've come to Earth. You risk disease. Yes, I do. There are some of us, Mr. Bailey, who feel that the future of the human race is even worth the possible loss of an extended lifetime. Too few of us, I am sorry to say. All right. We're coming to the point. How is Spacetown helping matters? In trying to introduce robots here on Earth, we're doing our best to upset the balance of your city economy. That's your way of helping? Bailey's lips quivered. You mean you're creating a growing group of displaced and declassified men on purpose? Not out of cruelty or callousness, believe me. A group of displaced men, as you call them, are what we need to serve as a nucleus for colonization. Your ancient America was discovered by ships fitted out with men from the prisons. Don't you see that the city's womb has failed the displaced man? He has nothing to lose and worlds to gain by leaving Earth. But it isn't working. No, it isn't, said Dr. Fastolf sadly. There is something wrong. The resentment of the Earthman for the robot blocks things. Yet those very robots can accompany humans, smooth the difficulties of initial adjustment to a raw world, make colonization practical. Then what? More outer worlds? No. The outer worlds were established before civism had spread over Earth, before the cities. The new colonies will be built by humans who have the city background plus the beginnings of a sci-fi culture. It will be a synthesis, a crossbreeding. As it stands now, Earth's own structure must go ricketing down in the near future. The outer worlds will slowly degenerate and decay in a somewhat further future. But the new colonies will be a new and healthy strain, combining the best of both cultures. By their reaction upon the older worlds, including Earth, we ourselves may gain new life. I don't know. It's all misty, Dr. Fastolf. It's a dream, yes. Think about it. Abruptly, the spacer rose to his feet. I have spent more time with you than I intended. In fact, more time than our health ordinances allow. You will excuse me. Baleonar Daniil left the dome. Sunlight, at a different angle, somewhat yellower, washed down upon them once again. In Bailey, there was a vague wonder whether sunlight might not seem different on another world. Less harsh and brazen, perhaps. More acceptable. Another world? The ugly spacer with the prominent ears had filled his mind with queer imaginings. Did the doctors of Aurora once look at the child Fastolf and wonder if he ought to be allowed to mature? Wasn't he too ugly? Or did their criteria include physical appearance at all? When did ugliness become a deformity? And what deformities? But when the sunlight vanished and they entered the first door that led to the personal, the mood became harder to maintain. Bailey shook his head with exasperation. It was all ridiculous. Forcing Earthmen to emigrate, to set up a new society, it was nonsense. What were these spacers really after? He thought about it and came to no conclusion. Slowly, their squad car rolled down the vehicular lane. Reality was surging all about Bailey. His blaster was a warm and comfortable weight against his hip. The noise and vibrant life of the city was just as warm, just as comfortable. For a moment, as the city closed in, his nose tingled to a slight and fugitive pungence. He thought wonderingly, the city smells. He thought of the 20 million human beings crammed into the steel walls of the great cave, and for the first time in his life he smelled them with nostrils that had been washed clean by outdoor air. He thought, would it be different on another world? Less people and more air? Cleaner? But the afternoon roar of the city was all around them. The smell faded and was gone, and he felt a little ashamed of himself. He let the drive rod in slowly and tapped a larger share of the beamed power. The squad car accelerated sharply as it slanted down into the empty motorway. Daniil, he said. Yes, Elijah. Why was Dr. Fastolf telling me all he did?
It seems probable to me, Elijah, that he wished to impress you with the importance of the investigation. We are not here just to solve a murder, but to save Spacetown and with it the future of the human race. Bailey said dryly, I think he'd have been better off if he'd let me see the scene of the crime and interview the men who first found the body. I doubt if you could have added anything, Elijah. We have been quite thorough. Have you? You've got nothing, not a clue, not a suspect. No, you are right. The answer must be in the city. To be accurate, though, we did have one suspect. What? You said nothing of this before. I did not feel it to be necessary, Elijah. Surely it is obvious to you that one suspect automatically existed. Who? In the devil's name, who? The one Earthman who was on the scene. Commissioner Julius Enderby. 10. Afternoon of a plainclothes man. The squad car veered to one side, halted against the impersonal concrete wall of the motorway. With the humming of its motor stopped, the silence was dead and thick. Bailey looked at the robot next to him and said, in an incongruously quiet voice, What? Time stretched while Bailey waited for an answer. A small and lonesome vibration rose and reached a minor peak, then faded. It was the sound of another squad car, boring its way past them on some unknown errand, perhaps a mile away. Or else it was a fire car hurrying along toward its own appointment with combustion. A detached portion of Bailey's mind wondered if any one man any longer knew all the motorways that twisted about in New York City's bowels. At no time in the day or night could the entire motorway system be completely empty. And yet, there must be individual passages that no man had entered in years. With sudden, devastating clarity, he remembered a short story he had viewed as a youngster. It concerned the motorways of London and began, quietly enough, with a murder. The murderer fled toward a prearranged hideout in the corner of a motorway in whose dust his own shoe prints had been the only disturbance for a century. In that abandoned hole, he could wait in complete safety till the search died. But he took a wrong turning, and in the silence and loneliness of those twisting corridors, he swore a mad and blaspheming oath that in spite of the Trinity and all the saints, he would yet reach his haven. From that time on, no turning was right. He wandered through an unending maze from the Brighton sector on the Channel to Norwich and from Coventry to Canterbury. He burrowed endlessly beneath the great city of London from end to end of its sprawl across the southeastern corner of medieval England. His clothes were rags and his shoes ribbons. His strength wore down but never left him. He was tired, but unable to stop. He could only go on and on with only wrong turnings ahead of him. Sometimes he heard the sound of passing cars, but they were always in the next corridor, and however fast he rushed, for he would gladly have given himself up by then, the corridors he reached were always empty. Sometimes he saw an exit far ahead that would lead to the city's life and breath, but it always glimmered further away as he approached, until he would turn, and it would be gone. Occasionally, Londoners on official business through the underground would see a misty figure limping silently toward them, a semi-transparent arm lifted in pleading, a mouth open and moving, but soundless. As it approached, it would waver and vanish. It was a story that had lost the attributes of ordinary fiction, and it entered the realm of folklore. The wandering Londoner had become a familiar phrase to all the world. In the depths of New York City, Bailey remembered the story and stirred uneasily. R. Daniel spoke, and there was a small echo to his voice. He said, We may be overheard. Down here? Not a chance. Now what about the commissioner? He was on the scene, Elijah. He is a city dweller. He was inevitably a suspect. Was? Is he still a suspect? No. His innocence was quickly established. For one thing, there was no blaster in his possession. There could not very well be one. He had entered Spacetown in the usual fashion. That was quite certain. And as you know, blasters are removed as a matter of course. Was the murder weapon found at all, by the way? No, Elijah. Every blaster in Spacetown was checked, and none had been fired for weeks. A check of the radiation chambers was quite conclusive. Then whoever had committed the murder had either hidden the weapon so well, it could not have been hidden anywhere in Spacetown. We were quite thorough. Bailey said impatiently, I'm trying to consider all possibilities. It was either hidden or it was carried away by the murderer when he left. Exactly. And if you admit only the second possibility, then the commissioner is cleared. Yes. As a precaution, of course, he was cerebro-analyzed. What? By cerebro-analysis, I mean the interpretation of the electromagnetic fields of the living brain cells. Oh, said Bailey, unenlightened. And what does that tell you? It gives us information concerning the temperamental and emotional makeup of an individual. In the case of Commissioner Enderby, it told us that he was incapable of killing Dr. Sarton. Quite incapable. No, agreed Bailey. He isn't the type. I could have told you that. It is better to have objective information. Naturally, all our people in Spacetown allowed themselves to be cerebro-analyzed as well. All incapable, I suppose? No question. It is why we know that the murderer must be a city dweller. Well, then, all we have to do is pass the whole city under your cute little process. It would not be very practical, Elijah. There might be millions temperamentally capable of the deed. Millions, grunted Bailey, thinking of the crowds of that long-ago day who had screamed at the dirty spacers and of the threatening and slobbering crowds outside the shoe store the night before. He thought, poor Julius, a suspect. He could hear the commissioner's voice describing the period after the discovery of the body. It was brutal, brutal. No wonder he broke his glasses in shock and dismay. No wonder he did not want to return to Spacetown. I hate them, he had ground out between his teeth. Poor Julius, the man who could handle spacers, the man whose greatest value to the city lay in his ability to get along with them. How much did that contribute to his rapid promotions? No wonder the commissioner had wanted Bailey to take over. Good old, loyal, closed-mouth Bailey. College chum. He would keep quiet if he found out about that little incident. Bailey wondered how cerebro-analysis was carried out. He imagined huge electrodes, busy pantographs skidding inclines across graphed paper, self-adjusting gears clicking into place now and then. Poor Julius. If his state of mind were as appalled as it almost had a right to be, he might already be seeing himself at the end of his career with a forced letter of resignation in the hands of the mayor. The squad car slanted up into the sublevels of City Hall.